This show is part of the Electric Agora network of podcasts.
Kathleen Stock, it's wonderful to see you.
It's good to see you, Dan.
Welcome to everyone in the Sophia audience. I'm very, very pleased today to be back with, Kathleen Stock, not back with. This is the first time we've done a dialogue together. Anybody who's been following me or reading any of me at all for the last years knows about what's going on with Kathleen and with the more general issues surrounding gender and sex. Just quick disclosures. I've known Kathleen since the early 2000s through an entirely separate connection, and that is through the British Society of Aesthetics. We both work in aesthetics for about 4 or 5 years. I was giving papers every year there, and I would go, and that's how I know Kathleen originally. And it's just a complete coincidence that I now know her through this issue as well. And the last disclosure I should say just is that I did organize the open letter defending Kathleen against attacks against her after she received her OBE. And so, you know, I'm compromised in that sense. I clearly am on a side. So I just want to be clear about all that. Kathleen is a professor. Are you a full professor?
Mm-hmm.
I know that some of the ranking, they have rankings in the UK that we don't have here, like reader and like, yeah. So I just want to, you're a full professor at the University of Sussex, which is in Bristol?
No, it's in Brighton. Near Brighton, yeah.
Your main work has been in aesthetics, correct?
Mm-hmm. Fiction and imagination.
But recently, would you say the bulk of your work has been in the sex and gender issue recently? Or you still have a portion carved off to do aesthetics in?
No, I don't actually. I've turned to sexual orientation, sex and gender full time, really. And I've also written a bit on sexual objectification. I've been doing that for a good few years now. So that's a sort of interest that kind gateway interest.
Sex and gender and feminism actually predates the current controversies.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got three publications on sexual objectification. And actually that really did partly, I mean, there's a lot of background that's got me here, but one of the relevant parts was doing objectification and reading people like Catherine MacKinnon who think that being objectified is sort of analytic for women. So that was startling.
Yeah. Okay, so we're here to discuss Kathleen's new book, Material Girls. I have not yet got my physical copy, so maybe Kathleen, you could hold it up.
Primed to do this. I don't just carry it around
Girls.
With me.
We're gonna talk about this book and about what it's about. Anybody who's again followed me and knows that I largely agree with Kathleen about a lot of things. And so this is not going to be sort of like let's fight together. I'm going to ask her about the book in the manner of somebody interviewing somebody about a book they've written. And, so I took a bunch of notes. I have a series of questions I'm going to ask. And so that people know what they have in store. Okay, so the first thing I'd like you to do, if you could, is just sort of describe the current state of affairs and surrounding sex and gender, about which the book is supposed to address. So, what is the current state of affairs such that you wrote this book?
Right. Well, I'm located in the UK, and this book is partly addressed to the UK situation, although it seems to be a situation that is now being replicated in other places, including the US, and it's already got going in Canada. So the main target of the book is this idea that it's something called gender identity, an inner feeling, roughly, although I go into some detail about what that is, that should be firstly prioritized over biological sex. Wherever biological sex was important socially or politically, we should replace that with this new notion, or relatively new notion, gender identity. And that involves changing spaces, public spaces, formerly women only spaces get redescribed in terms of inner feelings rather than sex. resources for women get redefined for a whole new category. And also, at the same time, there's an attempt to evacuate the language of any reference to sex. So things are going more gender neutral in some attempt to get any talk of sex out of the language. And that's really been going on in Britain for at least 5 years. So policies, public policies for many national institutions say that it's what we call self-ID that is the legitimate criterion of entry into a woman-only space or a male-only space, including changing rooms, bathrooms, showers, hostels, some prisons, refuges, and so on. So that's the context. Now, something that I think in particular North American onlookers perhaps miss is that we have gender reassignment protected in law in the UK, and that is not the target of this book. So I am not arguing against political protection for trans people. I have no ambitions to political ambitions personally to try and get the Gender Recognition Act rolled back. And that's what we have. The argument is about whether we change the protected characteristic of gender reassignment, which refers to a process, behavioral process or maybe a medical process, to something inner that really, by everyone's admission, cannot be perceived directly, which might change from day to day. And we're explicitly told it can be fluid. So that's the target. And then investigating all the harms that I think go with that.
The issue was sort of instigated, or your involvement was instigated by what were proposed as changes to the Gender Recognition Act, and then the protections that would and things that would come with it from a system in which there were sort of criteria. And processes that one had to undergo self-declaration, is that what's being suggested? Well,
so there's two laws that are relevant. There's the Gender Recognition Act and there's ambitions to change that, and then there's the Equality Act and there's ambitions to change that. And partly what was confusing and still is confusing is how the two interact, because the Equality Act protects sex and gender reassignment. Our lobbying groups, like Stonewall is a well-known, very influential lobbying group, has ambitions to change gender reassignment to gender identity, but it's already actually confused as to how gender reassignment interacts with sex when you're trying to work out how to manage public space, for instance, and places where women undress and get changed. And then at the same time, there's a move to change the Gender Recognition Act to self-ID, in the sense that they will remove any gatekeeping. There will be no requirement that you live in what they call the acquired gender for any particular amount of time. And it will just be a matter of self-declaration, filling in a form and paying a nominal amount. That's what the ambitions of the lobbying group. So,
okay. And that's what sort of created the current conflict, to the extent that there is one, that's resulted in political activism and all the stuff that people are seeing now going on, right?
I mean, there was a public government consultation when I got involved. We were being invited to give our views. Women anyone who dissented from the lobbying group's preferred outcome were immediately vilified, but we were being asked what we thought. So we certainly have a democratic right to say so. And I thought, as an academic, I have a right to think about this too.
Yes. Okay. Second question now about the book itself.
Sure.
How do you conceive of the aims of the book? Is it primarily informative? Here's the state of affairs. Mm-hmm. Is it primarily argumentative? Here's a position. Is it an exercise in activism itself? I mean, what is your? It's not an academic book, but it has a lot of academic depth and rigor in it. So what is your idea of what this thing is for?
Well, you're right. It's published by a mainstream publisher. And I would like it to be, I conceive of it as a work of popular philosophy. It's opinionated. It's you know, I cannot but be opinionated. But a lot of, I noticed as I started to engage with this debate that a lot of the political demands made on behalf of modern trans activism and in favor of gender identity had some kind of pseudo-philosophical basis. Quite often there's appeals, at least appeals to authority, like people like Judith Butler or Anne Fausto Sterling come up quite often in the popular discourse. You know, didn't you know that sex was a spectrum now, you know, stuff like that. So I thought, well, here's an opportunity for me to, you know, employ the things I think I'm good at, which are relative, you know, I don't know, we'll see, but explaining things relatively clearly that look complicated, which often aren't that complicated. I am trying to make it as accessible as possible and giving my opinionated take on where the arguments fail. And also, you know, but written for a mainstream audience, because I think there's such fear around this issue that, to my knowledge, this is the first book in a mainstream press that has ever been published like this. And, you know, that I think there's definitely space there for this sort of book at the moment. You know, I'm not sure if there were 20 other books like this, I'm not sure this book would stand out, but because there aren't any, it really then becomes important that it gets published, I think.
So you are presenting, the book intends to advance an argument regarding policy and also conceptual issues, but it's not solely an exercise in activism. You are also trying to do a philosophical exploration and also an ordinary person thinking person's examination of the issues.
I'm trying to do that. And I mean, I don't know whether it counts as activism as or not, because obviously I have a point of view that's political.
It eschews rhetorical. By way of rhetorical.
No, there are a few jokes.
There's some jokes.
I'm trying to, and also to be honest, when I wrote it, this may sound hard to believe some of my critics, but I didn't actually exactly know where I was going to end up. You know, I have followed my own arguments and thought things through. And I think that's demonstrated by the fact that I've ended up with positions that have caused, you know, relative uproar, both from trans activists and from feminists.
Nobody's very happy nobody on the very strong activist wings is very happy.
No, they're not.
And maybe that's just part of the reason, is because the book isn't primarily sort of an exercise in activism. It eschews a lot of rhetorical things that you would have in if you were writing like a polemic, you know what I mean?
You're right.
It doesn't have that quality.
It is an opinionated book and you'll see that, but I tried not to editorialize too much. So there are passages where I'm describing things which I think are clearly heinous, you know, consequences of this view, which I think are heinous, but I don't amp up my own horror, because I actually would just like people to read it and make have their own reactions. I take
trust
it
trust other people's emotions, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. That's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Okay. So let's get now into the meat of it. I'm going to try to. There's a few things I want to ask that will dip us somewhat into the weeds of philosophy, but I'm going to try to sort of keep it at the normie. In the normie frame as much as I can in terms of just how we talk about this. So let's start. The first thing in the book, you show some pretty dramatic statistics about just how quickly and recently this sort of thing this issue has exploded. Mm. The dramatic uptick in cases of people identifying as trans, especially amongst girls. Mm-hmm. And when it happened. And let me ask you, because this gets to questions of so-called social contagion, and you can sort of, which has taken on a sort of a horrible, I think it's taken on an unpleasant connotation that it needn't have, that then causes people to react very defensively. Mm-hmm. But what I want to ask is, and you can talk around that, but I want to ask you is, Is this radical uptick in cases credibly ascribed to, quote, greater awareness, greater reporting, as we know that mental health upticks in general sometimes are a result of greater awareness and greater reporting, simply because we weren't very great at handling psychological issues not too long ago. They were matters of shame. They were kept secret, especially in more conservative areas. And so there is a credible notion that you could have a pretty dramatic uptick. And it's not that anything has really changed very much. It's just that reporting and awareness has increased. Do you think that that's credible, a credible account in this, with the case of this sort of dramatic increases? Or do you think there's something about it that suggests that there's something else going on?
I mean, this is obviously you're asking me to make a causal claim. And to some extent, I just want to demur a bit and say, look, you know, that I think that's empirical. And I think we need to do more, much more research than is being currently done in the currently uncritical landscape, but relatively uncritical landscape. But I don't think it's credible that that's all that's going on. Although I do accept absolutely that there have always been people who I think there have always been people who have felt profoundly uneasy with their sex characteristics. But the rapid rise in for instance teenage girls, and a rise, pretty dramatic rise in teenage boys as well, actually, I think needs a different explanation. And I think we should look at it in the round. It partly involves relatively familiar experiences for women in particular that might manifest in different kinds of disorders, for instance, anorexia or self-harm or bulimia. You know, there's a host of ways in which teenagers can express discomfort at their bodies or about the expectations that society places upon their bodies. And I believe that since smartphones became ubiquitous, there's been a general rise in ill mental health for teenagers. There's been a rise in self-harm. There's been a rise in suicide attempts. So it's unlikely, I would have thought, that
I'm not so much asking you to make a verdict like you know. I guess I'm more inviting you to say, how do we determine whether, you know, what are the sort of considerations that go into determining whether a dramatic uptick is simply a matter of increased reporting? Because I don't even think people know how to think these things through, right? What are the sorts of considerations that you would look at to determine whether something is just a matter of increased reporting and awareness, or whether there's something else going on?
I mean, you're asking a question that really belongs to social scientists, I think, but I would look at comorbidity, I guess, like, you know, what else is going on for these children and teenagers. I want to know what they think. I mean, part of the trouble is we've got such a politicized atmosphere where educators, universities, even psychotherapists themselves are being encouraged to absolutely uncritically affirm, in inverted commas, people's self-interpretations, even children or teenagers' self-interpretations, which may of course be in flux. So we don't, and they're also being given a kind of hero's narrative, you know, like you are finding the real and authentic self and you are so brave. And, you know, so it's, I think it's less likely that we have a good access to like what's really going on for these children right now. Yeah. So we need to try and take the temperature down a bit and do a lot more talking and investigating and, you know, looking across the board at various statistics.
The issue is preventing us from doing good social science. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, definitely. I mean, this links into another big bugbear of mine, but in the UK, nearly all the UK universities are signed up to this scheme associated with Stonewall. So they are called Stonewall Diversity Champions. They get basically instructions from Stonewall as to how to talk about trans-identified people. And we must respect the identities, where respect is doing a lot of heavy lifting there for never say anything critical about the whole shebang, you know, the whole conceptual structure.
Yeah.
It's really, really against the odds at the moment to come up.
Yeah.
Having said that, it work is emerging more. I think I'm quite.
It seems to me like that too. Like emerging. More people are getting a little yeah. more willing to sort of just do the straight out work on it and take whatever abuse they're going to get for it. So the book spends quite a good amount of time on the role that various elements played in getting us to this point. And two that you talk about that strike me as interesting that I'd like you maybe to say a little bit about what you're saying in the book is the role that queer theory played and the role actually that second wave feminism played. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about each of those, what you say in the book about the role each of those played.
Well, I'll start with second wave feminism. I mean,
and define that, please, for people who don't know what that means.
Well, look, it's second wave feminism is feminism from the 60s and 70s, which kind of posited many of the kind of conceptual structures that feminism is very well known for, like patriarchy, like the importance of oppression, thinking of women as a class. I mean, the trouble is when you start to ask me to define it, then there's just huge variety in the range of possible positions that you could
but
have as a radical feminist or a second wave feminist.
Gloria Steinem and Andrea Dworkin, Bella Abzug, right? Or is Bella Abzug earlier? I mean, she's from the Betty Friedan sort of where it starts, you'd say?
She's on the cusp, but a lot of the late second wave feminists that you're most familiar with would have rejected Friedan, or some of aspects of Friedan anyway. It's the idea that women's not just a fight for equality in relatively superficial ways is the aim, you know, not just for the vote or for equal pay, but that we need to dismantle various structures, political structures, the marriage, the family, you know, it's a very all-encompassing project that's why I'm sort of hedging a bit, because within that project, there's just huge disagreements about the nature of woman and what the aim should be and so on. So it'd be hard to come up with a sort of set of axioms.
Sure.
But I don't go into, you know, I'm like, this is not a history.
No, I understand.
So I'm just taking one thing roughly, or a couple of things that I think of as significant for the trajectory of this debate from second wave feminism. The same goes for queer theory. I just really talk about Judith Butler, and then I talk about a few other people along the way. But so I want to be specific, because one of the things you'll find if you get into this debate that you get constantly attacked for is your scholarship. You know, in other words, you haven't read.
You haven't
Bible.
Done the reading. You haven't done the reading.
You haven't deferred to the priests. You really don't understand what you're talking about. So I'm just trying to lower expectations. This is not Radical Feminist 101. But what I focus on in the book is a couple of moves. One of them is the move from sex to gender, which originally looked perfectly innocuous to me, I think. But, you know, there is sex, and then there are the social meanings around sex. Let's call those masculinity and femininity, and let's say that they culturally, they differ from culture to culture and historical period to historical period. And I try and steer clear of the whole, is it innate or not issue, because that just seems to me to make everything worse. So that would be sex and gender in the way it was originally conceived. But then at some point, some radical feminists started to argue that if we thought of sex itself as constructed via patriarchy somehow, I mean, I guess they must have thought in some sense that was empirically true, but they also thought that it was really neat because it removed the threat of biological determinism, which is the idea that women and girls are biologically determined to be not very bright and be domesticated and have children and, you know, that stuff. So that was a threat at that time from the patriarchy, and some subset of radical feminists thought, well, we can get rid of that threat by redefining womanhood as something social. They weren't doing it to be trans inclusive. That was a you know, a million miles away from their heads, I think. They were doing it in as a strategic move. I think it was a disastrous move for many reasons. It then led to the problem of which social experiences you would privilege as the criterial ones for womanhood. And that was a big row. But it also opened up space later on for people to say, well, if womanhood's social, then occupying the right social role is sufficient for womanhood, so you don't need to be female anymore. So that's one move I focus on. And then, but I also just talk in the first chapter a bit about Judith Butler, and then I come back to her in the second chapter. Judith Butler obviously also thinks that sex is socially constructed. I mean, she's not necessarily, she's influenced by Monique Wittig, for instance, explicitly, who is a radical feminist. But she doesn't, as I read her, place any particular emphasis on the patriarchy as the source of the construction. It's more that she's interested in demolishing what she thinks of as heteronormativity and its association, what she thinks of as its sort of cultural connections with womanhood and manhood as categories, as binary categories. So I focus on those two moves to give some sense of part of the story that's led us up to where we are.
Yeah, yeah. You see sometimes in the, you know, there's a kind of an opportunistic right-wing version of this where mm-hmm. they're like, you know, you second wave feminists kind of now are getting what you asked for, you know what I mean? Which I always thought was not only, you know, really unkind, but also kind of
stupid. If we're all the same.
Kind of stupid, like... right? In the sense that, first of all, the second wave feminist movement was very complex, as you point out. And secondly, you can understand perfectly well why they went down the road they did. And to other than expecting omniscience of people, there's no way that they could have known, you know, all the, sure. the different ways this was going to go, right?
Sure, although I do think that move is just so transparently bad.
Yeah.
But I don't blame anyone for making bad philosophical moves. And certainly they couldn't see how it was going to pan out. I do think that when people, you're right, people often sort of beneath the line of Colette comments yeah. or something say, yeah. well, you brought this all on yourself, stock. Like, what, me personally? Because I was like born in 72. So.
I was born in 68. I mean, yeah. yeah. Let me ask you something. What's something you don't talk about that I was wondering about? And if you don't think there's anything to this, we'll just go on to the next thing. Do you think that there's anything, any role that's being played in this by the increasing tendency to turn illnesses, disabilities, et cetera, into identities? So here's something, like example, right? You'll get very radical people in, let's say, the deaf community, right? Mm-hmm. Who want to say that deafness is an identity. I've actually read people arguing that you should be allowed to deafen your own children where they're born because it's an identity, right? You know, I've heard this said about autism, right? That it's an identity, neurotypical mm-hmm. versus neurodivergent. Is there some relation? Do you think that there's something going on in this area of how we generally are dealing with and
yeah.
turning things that used to be considered illnesses or disabilities into identities, sex and gender?
I mean, I think there's a general cultural Western trend in that direction that comes partly from some kind of weird offshoot of liberalism and, you know, stripping back. Well, I don't know. I don't exactly know how the trajectory goes, because on the one hand, I think people are trying to say that their animal natures are to be transcended completely, but then you there's a vacuum, so you've got to fill it with like the things that differentiate you from others, like, or at least make you something. But I don't think it's going to be straightforward. I think like that's the trend, and then there'll be hermeneutic relations between all the areas in which people are finding new identities. It also, you know, it there's something positive in it. I don't think we should be completely scathing about it, because it's understandable.
Oh, I'm not. That's why I'm asking.
I mean, it's understandable that people don't want to constantly think of themselves
as broken or lesser.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
I completely understand that for various reasons, personal reasons. So I just,
like, it's, do you just think that this is going to generalize though? Like, I mean, do you think that we're going to start seeing in other areas, for example, people to start advocating on behalf of, let's say, surgeries for body dysmorphic people? In other words, how far do you think this is going to generalize? Or do you think it's so specific to the gender sex thing that it's not going to generalize? I mean, are we going to start saying we should amputate people's legs who are body dysmorphic? Or do you think that
some people are already saying enough? That?
Are the issues different enough?
I don't know. I'm not an oracle. I mean, I wouldn't have thought it would have got this far. Yeah. So I think that there's something very powerful pulsing through the zeitgeist at the moment. It's also quite commercially interesting to big companies to, you know, the more identities there are, the more you can commodify the identities. And that you, it's clear from so-called trans medicine, which seems to me full of, you know, people that are not operating by normal standards, that there are people willing to exploit younger, particularly younger people's identity disorders, you might say, or dysphoria, in order to make money. There's like surgeons advertising on TikTok to do double mastectomies for teenagers.
So, yeah, I've seen that.
I wouldn't have predicted that. God knows where we'll end up, but let's hope not.
Although predatory marketing to young people, I mean, this is why in America, you know, in the 70s, it used to be illegal to advertise on children's programming. And then, you know, we deregulated all of it. And so, I mean, the idea of this sort of predatory relationship between, you know, providers of goods and services and children is depressingly, unfortunately, quite well known. So we have, you talk in the book about several sort of major things that you think led up to this point. The next sort of things you do is you talk about why you think it's important to retain a substantial notion of sex and not to entirely shift over to a gender where we just individuate by gender. And then you also give a quite thorough analysis of the different accounts of gender identity, different versions of it. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk about each of those in a little bit about what you're trying to do in the book, both on the why you think it's important that we retain individuation by sex as well as individuation by gender, and then some of the different major different accounts of gender.
You might have to remind me of the second bit if I get lost.
Yeah, sure, that's fine. Whichever.
I mean, it probably seems bizarre to some listeners that I'd have to spend like a chapter on what is biological sex and B, a chapter on why does it matter socially? But nonetheless, I just do. I mean, in some progressive parts of the world, that conversation is needed. So why it matters socially, I focus on four areas where I think it unambiguously matters. I mean, there's obviously lots of other areas you could say it matters, but then there can be arguments about whether that's sort of contingent or it looks a bit more contingent. So I choose four where it looks pretty much non-negotiable. And so the first one is medicine. Second one is sport. The third one is sexual orientation or accounts of sexual orientation. And the fourth one is the difference that sex makes within heterosexual relations, because heterosexuality is the only sexual grouping where two different sized and strengthed people are regularly, on average, put in contact with each other. So that makes a difference to sexual assault statistics and domestic violence statistics. It's not a coincidence that women are, constitute most of the people that are sexually assaulted and males are mostly the perpetrators. So I just spell all that out, really, and try and deal along the way with some bad arguments about why, you know, sex doesn't matter in sport.
So in the case, give a little blurb on each one. So in the case of medicine, it matters because diseases track male female. Yeah,
in some cases they do. I mean, there's just evidence out there. Anyone can look that your prognosis, your likelihood of getting certain diseases may differ depending on your sex or maybe influenced by your sex. Your outcomes may differ. Your pain medication doses that you need may differ. The side effects that you experience may differ. You really need your healthcare provider to know what sex you are. And actually, there have been, I believe, some really terrible cases where doctors have made false assumptions about the sex of the patient they're dealing with. And there's been bad outcomes for that patient. So,
I mean, I know it's almost amazing that it has to be said. I mean, you know, everybody knows. There are male specific doctors for male specific things, right? I go to a doctor for things you're not going to be going to a doctor for. Yeah. Like my enlarged prostate, right?
Yeah.
You are going to be going to your doctor for things that I'm not going to be going to. Like the hot flashes that you have after, you know, my poor wife has been, after my poor wife went through menopause. In other words, the question is, we're trying not to caricature. That's not the point. We're not being rhetorical. There must be some idea behind, or do you think there's no idea behind this, that this is just, this part of it is really just completely political, has no real sense. They kind of even know it makes no real sense, but it's part of a political tactic. I mean, this just seems obvious beyond.
Yeah, right? It does seem obvious, but you know, my main thesis, or one of the important theses in the book, I think, and possibly one that's sort of not being explored by other people as much, and I think this is where my previous expertise in fiction comes to bear, is that people are immersed in a fiction when they say that they've changed sex often, or when they say others can change sex. And the reason I mention this is because when you're immersed in a fiction, you're not truth tracking in the normal way. You're not, you know, you're not responsive to evidence in the normal way. Your main motivation is to make, you know, you can grab bits of reality and fold them into your fiction, but your aim is aesthetic realism, not truth. You know, because truth is that this is a fiction, and you know, so on some level, you know this, because when you're immersed in a fiction, you still have access to the facts. If you were really pressed, I assume people still go to the doctor.
Yeah, you still have to go get
and disclose their sex.
You still have to go get your prostate checked or whatever.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
but it's, and especially for kids who are online, really politically active and think that they're saving lives by denying the existence or importance of sex, you know, and it's behind the whole discussion, the whole vocabulary of pregnant people or cervix havers. Now, of course, you're actually, this goes to show how ridiculous it is, because you're referring to biological aspects of bodies. It's actually more biological to talk about a cervix haver, arguably, than a woman. Certainly more kind of draws more attention to the body, but it's just a misguided attempt to evacuate sex from our language where it might disturb someone to hear it. And it's just out of control.
Yeah. Yeah. In the case of athletics, again, it has to do with physical, the simple that sports are about physical activity, and thus,
and there's a performance gap.
The physicality is relevant, not how we identify. Right.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a absolutely trackable performance gap.
Yeah.
On average, between males and females, like an exceptionally pronounced one.
Yeah.
To the point where high school male athletes can beat the faster times of women ever, you know. Or I just saw one today just now about the performance gap between the male punch and the female punch, bearing in mind that kickboxing has now apparently gone trans inclusive, you know. So,
yeah.
It's, again, it's a fiction. It's a fiction. And I think these people, a lot of the people involved in making these policies, who mostly are not trans, know this on some level of but they're really immersed in this other story.
But let me ask you, where does it sort of cross over to where, I was interested when you talked not just about physical pathologies that males and females face different ones, but you also talked some about social ones. And I guess, you know, I'm wondering where at one point, is it indeed more a matter of gender than sex? In other words, the way we socialize males as opposed to the way that we socialize females in terms of social pathologies, right? Like, surely there is a testosterone element to males' increased violence, right? But it surely also has to do with a lot of very bad socialization, right, that we're doing, right?
Well, I've I've explicitly stayed neutral on that. I'm not saying I won't discuss it, but I'm just making clear because I think either way, pretending it's not there, the effect is not there, is crazy. Now, it is part of some kind of Foucauldian, Butlerian academic strategy to act as if the differences aren't there and somehow think that they're creating utopia where they will be demolished. But, you know, that would be, even if all these differences were socially constructed, we'd still need an exit plan. Like, and it would have to be quite gradual, and we'd really have to take care of all the people that would be caught up, because, you know, whether it's social or not, men hit women, and whether it's men rape, you know, whether it's social or not, men rape women, and we can't just get rid of all the social, precisely social barriers we have put up to protect women in order allegedly to remove the characteristic which gave rise to them. It's just the wrong way around. So that's you know, I don't know. That, again, it's an empirical question.
Yeah.
That one.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how we find out the answer, but
and even if it is the case, it still winds up, you still need to individuate by males and females, because the negative socialization is being applied to males is the point, right?
And even, I mean, it's, nothing is purely social or purely biological. It's always some kind of mixture. So, I mean, I didn't discuss whether testosterone makes men more aggressive, but I know that testosterone makes their muscles bigger.
Yeah, that's right.
And I know it gives them a bigger kick and a bigger punch. And like, if you're tackling a male as a woman, you're likely to be knocked over. You know, and I'm a 6 foot woman, but my upper body strength is shit.
Yeah.
You know, if you try, I always think it'd be a really fast route. Maybe I'm just being naive. A fast route into convincing a lot of trans activists, just tell them to arm wrestle somebody of the opposite sex. You know, I mean, on a regular basis.
Yeah. You do go into some detail about what you take to be the different models of gender identity. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could talk a little, just give us a little summary of what you take those models, the basic models to be.
Well, the one I have most critical words for is what I call the stick of rock model, because in my head anyway, it whenever I hear it being adverted to, I think the image would be gender identity, like going through, like, do you have rock in the US? Like, it's a kind of candy that you eat at the
rock,
seaside.
They call it rock candy, but yes.
Okay. Well, you know, it's got like words going through it all the way up. And I feel like we're being told that if you just sort of like slice them in half, you'd find their gender identity in there. So this kind of model says it's innate. It's permanent. It's there waiting to be discovered. It's the real you. It's the authentic self. Like, the whole rhetoric around it is, it's very essential. It's a centralized kind of a view, you know, that you find your real self, and all these books say things like you and your gender identity, you know, how can you discover it? And it's very much a model of discovery rather than creation or development. So I have a lot of criticism of that particular view, partly because I just don't think there's, all the studies that I looked at that seemed to suggest that gender identity was innate showed nothing like that. And when you actually looked at them, and also partly
there's something I don't quite understand about it. And maybe what I'm not understanding is the point is that it's incoherent, but if there's a better version of this, then maybe you could tell me what it is, but I don't really understand. So much of what constitutes gender identity is socially inflected. So I don't see how it could be something that's natal. I don't understand how could something that depends upon social and particularly indexed social characteristics, right? You know, modern post-industrial social characteristics. Sure. How could that possibly be innate? Or is it that they're thinking of something else?
I mean, this is a populist view, right? So I'm not saying, and I don't say in the book, that academics, actually some academics do talk as if they're endorsing this one, but, you know, our philosophers, let's say, or let's hope, you know, that philosophers aren't going to endorse this one. They're going to have one of the other ones that I talk about. But so, yeah, I think it is incoherent. I just think it's almost like, I mean, this has been said by many, it's sort of more like an archetypal view that goes back to something like a soul. Well,
like something Jungian, almost something Jungian, you think?
Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't mean a Jungian archetypal.
Okay. But I think you would say we have that, right?
Yeah, Jung thinks we've got masculinity and femininity in all of us, I think. No, I just think, like, you know, the dualism, the kind of your soul emerging separate from your body, and it's the real you. And
it's kind of Cartesian, you know, like a little bit, you think.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But it fits with a lot of our cultural reference points, you know, in a relatively unthinking way. And of course, it's a very comforting narrative to people, to trans people, you know, that it's not anything they chose, that it's been there from the beginning, that they, you know, they, that it's a brave act to express their authentic inner self.
And this is where you get the language of born in the wrong body. This sure. is where you get the language of, I was a girl from the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And yeah. I always was. Yeah. And it's also where you get in the Yogyakarta principles, which I talk about in the first chapter, but you get this one principle, which talks about, and I can't remember exactly how it goes now. Yeah, I shouldn't have put this up, but it's basically about everyone's right to express their identity understood as a fundamental part of themselves. So it assumes that everyone's got a gender identity, you know, and if you don't feel variance with your body, then your gender identity must be sort of congruent with your body, your sex body, but
and
you still have one.
Cis. That's the cis person.
Yeah. So yeah, if you're cis, you have a gender identity, you've got a female, I've got a female gender identity that's congruent with my outward presentation. So it assumes everyone's got one, and somehow the world is constructed for those whose gender identities fit their bodies. But yes. there are these people whose gender identities don't fit their bodies, and we need to make life much easier for them because their real selves are being held back, you know. And I have a number of critical things to say about that. Then I talk about the medical model. I mean, there's probably overlap between these as well. I mean, when I'm doing it in my own idiosyncratic way, but the medical model is more like focusing on dysphoria as a dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And something to be corrected by correcting the body. So there is definitely overlap here, but it's more, there's a focus on kind of comorbidity and medicalization. And an emphasis.
And that was the dominant model, was it not?
Yeah,
until relatively recently, when the more non-binary identities became more prevalent in the movement. And so it kind of moved away from.
Well, I think the medicalization model was dominant, but I think back in the 20th, late, you know, second half of the 20th century, there was also critique of the medical model, because it's not, especially from the more radical elements, that you know, it's not that radical to, or it doesn't, from some perspectives, it doesn't look that radical to make your body into a kind of stereotypically feminine or masculine shape. So there's the third one I look at is more influenced by queer theory, and this is like gender identity as political, really, I suppose, like as a radical act.
View, the performance view?
Well, yeah, I don't know if I call
yeah,
it that?
You use the, yeah, you right, use the okay. expression performances, yeah.
Well, I mean, Judith Butler thinks that gender is a performance, you know, and she, by that
also.
She includes sex. Well, she thinks sex is socially constructed, so it's just that's another kind of performance. But, you know, so what we really should be doing, there's these, you know, we've got a sort of heteronormative world which privileges two particular performances, man and woman, and we need to disrupt this. And so queer the binary and perform gender differently, and that might be through being trans or drag or being non-binary. So it's that the queer theory model, as I understand it, is much less likely to say it's innate. Or
actually kind of opposed to each other, right?
I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, actually, so I actually say I've got a lot of sympathy with the queer theory model. It's much more sensible than the stick of rock model that sees it as this kind of innate permanent fact about you. The queer theory model allows it can develop, and it can be a means of self-expression and, well, self-expression, some non-literal sense of self. But it's also, it doesn't fit very well with the way things are going in the UK policy-wise. You know, if gender identity is really that fluid, like, then it's, there's obviously tensions there with how we set up spaces in terms of gender identity.
If it can
change from minute to minute.
There are practical constraints, right?
Yes, exactly. I really don't think that people writing in the 70s and 80s about this thought that they would be in a situation 40 years later where government officials would be trying to set up social spaces and women-only spaces according to ideas about gender identity.
So is the problem you have with the queer theory version that they try to apply it to sex as well as gender? Is that the main problem you have?
Well, that is a problem. Yeah, I think they should leave sex. Sex is sex and it exists and it's material. And the fact that I've laid out in the earlier chapters are non-negotiable. No matter how people identify, you know, no matter how a woman identifies, she's still more likely to be raped than a man.
Yeah.
So, you know, that aspect of reality is just missing from the discussion. And I think it has to be in there. But I have nothing, I mean, so my own preferred account of gender identity is that, you know, that so I looked for some kind of view that would incorporate various permutations and was relatively broad. And it's not going to be that surprising to people, but it's like a strong psychological identification with the opposite sex or with androgyny. So you re- and I talk about the importance of identification, because it's not, you know, identification as a psychological phenomenon is can be expressed through identifying with football teams or pop stars, or, you know, it's a familiar enough thing in our lives and it can be valuable. It can shape then how you interpret yourself. You can feel very like some other thing or some other person, and then identification makes you feel more like them, you know, and you feel like you're merging. You know, so I talk a little bit about what I understand to be the psychology of identification generally, and then I try and relate it to gender identity.
I just want to close my window.
Sure.
The gardeners, the lawnmower, the lawnmowers are out.
I thought you were in a mall. I thought you were in Ridgemont Mall.
Oh, that's just so that nobody can see what my room looks like. So let's leave aside the stigma. What is it? What did you call it? Stick of rock model. Let's leave that one aside. All the rest of them strike me as boiling down ultimately to some version of either feeling like a woman / man, or feeling identifying womanly-ish, manly-ish, mm-hmm. right? And I guess I don't see, and maybe you can tell me if there's any sort of better version of this. I don't see how you make sense of the idea of feeling like a man or feeling like a woman. I could, if you ask me what it is to feel like a man, I could not answer you. I could tell you that there are things that only men feel, right? Like the pain of an enlarged prostate, right? But I couldn't tell you what it feels like to be a man. I don't think that there's any such thing. And feeling manly-ish or womanly-ish just strikes me as obviously retrograde, right? I mean, that's just identifying with the stereotypes and
this is where I come apart from everybody. And I have to also stress.
What am I missing?
Well, so first of all, I just want to stress that this has got nothing to do with whether you are a woman or a man, as far as I'm concerned. So in the chapter afterwards,
I'm talking about gender.
About what
now.
Makes you a woman and a man. But everyone needs to remember that, because the two, especially in the UK, have become so merged that if I go easy on gender identity, they think I'm going easy on accounts of womanhood and manhood. I'm not. I'm not saying that, literally speaking, trans women are women because they have female gender identities at all. I'm just saying, what is a gender identity? And I think, first of all, I think you don't necessarily feel like a man, but that does, and I don't feel like a woman, as it were, in the sense that is anything other than just looking at myself and going, oh yeah, that's what I am. But that doesn't mean others don't. And I think,
have you heard a clear articulation of what that means to feel like a man or a woman?
You feel like you fit better in the other category, like, for whatever that means. You feel like your body is wrong, your mind is wrong, you are ill at ease in the world, you really, really want to be in a different body, or you identify very strongly with women but you're a man, or you see yourself as feminine. I mean, I think that makes perfect sense. I don't see why
those conceptions, when you ask then, well, what characterizes those feelings, isn't the answer some sort of stereotypical treatment of?
Yes, but listen, stereotypes, this is another heresy.
Yeah, go ahead.
Stereotypes are built into human life. Like, not all stereotypes, we can't avoid them. So what else was it going to be? But it doesn't mean it's regressive. Mm. And even if it is regressive, it's certainly nothing that can help. I mean, it's just everything we, every sartorial choice we make as a man or a woman is to some extent informed by a background context of stereotypes. So, for instance, so I don't know that that's a problem either. And it's certainly nothing for which trans people or people with gender identity or gender dysphoria, gender identity disorders should feel. I have no problem with that. It's when you start saying, well, that's what actually makes you a woman that you get into regressive.
I guess, though, but the reason I kind of push on it a little bit is because surely part of a good part of the point of purpose of second wave feminism was to point out and problematize the sort of the very damaging characteristics of those stereotypes, right? I mean, I was raised on the Free to Be You and Me record, right? And the whole point of that was to say that the fact that you like trucks, right, doesn't in any way mean that you're not either not a woman or that you're not the right kind, a good kind of woman, right?
Sure, I mean,
not regressive then?
I'm not, but I, for a start, there are obviously certain aspects of masculinity and femininity, many of them which are regressive. I'm not denying that, and which are stereotypes we should probably try and alter. But I think gender identity, as I understand it, in this way of like a really strong psychological identification with an ideal of masculinity or femininity or androgyny, at most could be like structurally regressive. It's not personally the fault of anyone, in the same way as it's not the fault of a woman who wears high heels or, you know, a man who likes to work out that he is conforming to a stereotype. And I'm not saying this makes you a man or a woman. And also I think a lot of people with a lot of females with male gender identities, that includes butch lesbians, and they do not necessarily think it makes them men. So I think we should separate all these things out. They are being pushed together by activism, but actually conceptually they're different. You can have gender identity of the opposite sex, as it were, without thinking that means that you are in the wrong body. It's just that we're being encouraged to make that decision.
I understand the point. I mean, that a stereotype can be employed regressively does not mean that everybody who fulfills the stereotype is being regressive. So,
or even who likes the stereotype.
Yes. No. I, that's a very fair point. I don't think that's obvious, though. I mean, I think that needs to be talked through.
Sure,
I think that's very easy to miss.
I think I try.
Yeah. No. I'm not saying you don't. I'm saying our public conversation needs to have this.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I'm aware of the time. I don't want to push you too far in terms of your time, but do you have 5 more minutes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I do want to do a little bit of sort of deeper dive philosophy, because you do start getting into things like conceptual analysis at the end and so on and so forth.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. Yeah.
How concepts work. Let's forget about the merits of any of these positions, okay? Mm. The meanings of words, right? What is it you're trying to get at in these sections of the book where you talk about how concepts work and our customary uses of words like man and woman in ordinary discourse? Just give us a little bit, try to bridge the gap to the technical philosophy so that an ordinary reader can understand.
Okay. Well, the stalking horse is the kind of post-structuralist view that I understand it of concepts, which sees them as kind of oppressive impositions that create rather than discover. So like they create power imbalances. Saying there are men and women is basically to create a normative standard for men and women, such that if you fail to meet it, you're excluded politically. So everything's political, everything is about power. Nothing is about just simply recording or reflecting what was already there. So I'm trying to get present a different perspective on concepts as things, at least some of them, that, you know, we have as a human species developed over time to reflect the world we find around us, that allow us to refer to things, you know, of the same type, or that persist over time, you know, to make interest relative observations and predictions. So the feature and causal explanations and counterfactual explanations and things like that. So, and I think woman and man are almost paradigmatic examples of concepts which don't have any sort of sinister evaluative content built into them or conditions. They are descriptive as it gets. And they are there to help us negotiate the world in which all of us find ourselves, because all of us are in, you know, in a world of sexual dimorphism, where you know, humans are a sexually dimorphic species. So I'm trying to present the positive case for the retention of woman as a concept or category, which refers to adult human females, and men or man as a concept that refers to adult human males, and to see off all the challenges that are coming to this, you know, from within analytic philosophy, even bizarrely, saying that we need to ameliorate these concepts. We need, like, as a political project, we need to re-engineer them to make them more inclusive. I think the last thing you need to do with a concept that functions well is to make it inclusive. That means it doesn't work.
That means inclusive in the sense to make any distinctions. That's right.
Yeah, you just bring in another kind of thing, and then you lose the capacity to make the differentiation you needed to make. So
in your view, is it that essentially the term males and the term men are at least materially equivalent?
No, because there's boys, but but that's
add
it.
That
yeah.
part. Add that part.
Well, and there's male ducks, and I think we've got males and females, and that covers non-human species.
Yeah.
So we need a
and
word.
Men or women are the human versions.
Yeah, human they're the word. Human versions, and they're the adult versions, because in human life, almost uniquely, not uniquely, but you know, there's a real need to have a concept that differentiates the people over the age of majority from the people who aren't, although it's relatively possibly arbitrary where we put that line. But we need a concept for children and adults, you know, and it's not so important to have a concept for older whales and younger whales, although actually if you do whale science there probably is. But so it's perfectly it's perfectly understandable that we've got a concept of women and girl and man and boy.
So a lot of times it'll be pointed out that, well, you know, the meanings of words change over time and all of that sort of thing. And I always try to, whenever I get into these arguments, people, I'm like, yeah, but they usually don't by fiat. I mean, it's usually an evolution of customary use that involves a lot of social negotiation. It's not something that can just be declared or stipulated. I do get a feeling like we are in a period now where there is a battle over an effort to try to change the customary uses of words, and that the people are just a little impatient, right? I mean, in the sense that they want it to happen faster, and they're not willing to countenance that they may lose the social negotiation and it may not change. But do you foresee this, the customary use of man and woman, changing to the point to which it is going to become?
Not to the point where womanhood is going to turn out to depend necessarily and sufficiently on what kind of inner feelings you have, because same goes for manhood. That's not just a slow, gradual, stepwise change. That's a total change of subject.
Yeah.
You know, that is just talking about apples and then talking about chairs and pretending that you are still talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
So that new concept that's being urged on us by some is a different concept, maybe with the same word being applied, but it's different. And it could never, as I stress in the book, fulfill the multiple categorical roles in which we use the former.
Yeah.
And I actually then make a case that even the sort of more interim position, which is woman as a social role and man as a social role, could never fulfill the original concept, which we still need. Because I hope I've demonstrated over the early parts of the book that we still need that concept, because sex still exists and it still sort of predictably has all these causal effects. So we need a concept to explain what it is that is participating in the causal effects.
Just one or two remaining things. You are a what in philosophy we'd call a realist about male and female biology, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you, mm-hmm. do you have to be a realist about natural kinds
to be a realist
about this? That's one of the things I've been curious about.
Actually, the position I'm most attracted to, although I'm, and I've, I think I said it in my sexual orientation paper, is promiscuous realism. So, so that is roughly, so John Dupré, I read John Dupré's book, I think it's called The Order of Things, and I really like that book. But roughly, we develop the concepts that fit partly the way the world is in some sense, but also our interests in it. So we have many, many more concepts for vertebrates than invertebrates, because we eat vertebrates, we use them for work and so on. We don't have that much interest in invertebrates. So, and there's different ways of carving up what there is relative to our interests. And so there's no one, you know, it's not necessarily one story about what there is, but it's not all bets are off, you know, it's all arbitrary either. So I think what I say is compatible with that. Although having said that, I don't think for women and men that there's any convincing story about why we don't still need those concepts. And you can see that in the way, the fact that those concepts are ubiquitous in every culture, in every language, you know, from the year dot.
Yeah.
I'm sure gender scholars at this point will pop up to give me some spurious counterexamples, but I don't believe them.
Yeah, two spirits and all this stuff. I don't want to get into that. That's just sort of boring. That's boring in the sense that it's, I want to talk about the stuff that there might be some merit to, as opposed to things that are just, you know, that people just lamp, you know, make some mock and stuff.
Yeah, colonialism invented it.
So to be clear, though, you don't think that one doesn't have to take a position on the realism or anti-realism regarding natural kinds to hold the view that you want to hold?
Well, it depends what you mean by realism, because there's sort of more generous versions of realism. I'm not an anti-realist. I think you have to be a kind of realist, yes.
Okay.
You need to be a realist. I'm just saying you don't have to be. I haven't looked recently at the literature, so I can't remember all the different kinds of realism, but you could be a promiscuous realist, I think.
The reason I'm asking is because if one is a realist about natural kinds, then what sort of puzzles me a little bit is that it's never been thought that a handful of anomalous cases are sufficient to undermine a natural classification. In other words, the fact that there are three-legged dogs doesn't mean that dogs aren't quadrupeds, right? I mean, in other words, now, if you were an anti-realist about natural kinds, I could see you spinning some yarn, right, about this, right, and sort of talking about the social construction of, you know, some Nelson Goodman-esque, like, you know, where we carve things up, you know, are there really galaxies or constellations or whatever? That's why I'm wondering whether to any extent your view does depend on a certain amount of realism about natural kinds.
I'd have to look at, like, what the anti-realist would say, but, you know, the variation that's significant for supposedly disrupting human males and human females as categories is really a small number of cases.
It's a tiny number of cases.
I mean, as I say in the book, the figure that gets bandied about, that, you know, 1.7% of the population are intersex, is preposterous.
But and even it turns if they out were, it wouldn't be enough.
Well, it wouldn't be enough, but it's actually 0.002% of people with, you know, some genuine ambiguity. And even there's at least two models of sex according to which most of those can be pretty easily classified too.
Yeah.
So we're talking about biology. There's going to be variation. It goes with the territory in biology. But yes, the idea
albino that those tigers, I mean, you know, I mean, it's like this, you know, and the literature is so full of this. I mean,
yeah. So this is just an analytic example.
Philosophy education and not read Putnam on lemons and all this sort of stuff. Right. I mean,
yeah. This is an example again, where there's got to be some sociological explanation for why academic philosophers working in philosophy of feminism do not apparently recognize this sort of thing that we're saying. You know, they make so much of the so-called intersex cases, which is totally instrumentalizing, by the way. I still, even if we did acknowledge that, I would still want to know how we got from talking about people who are born with significant variation that are absolutely non-negotiable and permanent to adults choosing to take hormones, you know, and what the steps of that argument are supposed to be, which just get absolutely glossed over. But it just seems, you know, the political aims of feminist philosophers has made them lose their philosophical
Last question thing we didn't touch on yet, we've talked entirely about the impact and the relationship with feminism and women. We haven't said anything about the relationship with homosexuality. And you do have an entire section about why this matters. And maybe we could close just on you saying on what the intersection of this issue with gay and lesbian issues is and why you think it matters so much.
Well, in the new gender identity paradigm, since we can no longer speak of sex, as Wittgenstein say or something, and we must replace the context in which we talk to biological sex with talk of gender identity, we must therefore redefine sexual orientations in terms of gender identity. And that is what GLAAD has done. That is what Stonewall have done. So now a lesbian is someone with a female gender identity attracted to others with female gender identities. Now in practice, that can and often does mean a trans woman attracted to females, you know, predictably.
People who formerly have counted as heterosexual are now going to count
as lesbians.
Homosexual is now going to become a sexually heterogeneous.
It's an identity.
Class.
Yes, exactly. It's an identity. Yes. And this is...
Why does this matter so much?
Well, it matters, right, for a couple of reasons. One is that arguably, I don't think just arguably, in fact, the kinds of homophobia that gay people often experience have nothing to do with inner gender identity, because that's imperceptible. They have to do with perceivable sex, two people of the same sex kissing or, you know, holding hands, for instance. It's got nothing to do with gender identity. It also has important effects on younger people immersed in this queer LGBT mismatch culture, which says that you must accept people's gender identity as the determining factor. So you now have males in lesbian communities.
Dating apps. Dating apps
or like youth groups or whatever, saying I'm a lesbian too. You should at least in principle be open to having sex with me because I'm a lesbian like you. And if you're not in principle open to at least to having sex with some trans women, you must be transphobic. And that's not, you know, that's not, I think too much is made of that. And sometimes, you know, it's not like a direct pressure, but it is a pressure. It's a moral pressure to change your sexual orientation. And women, girls, lesbians who are discovering their sexuality have enough trouble, you know, discovering their sexual orientation and letting it grow and develop without feeling morally pressured to have sex with people of the opposite sex, because that is what it is. And now in like lesbian magazines, you see how to have sex with a trans woman, you know, except you won't refer to their penis very explicitly, but it's obvious that there is a penis involved. It's heterosexual sex being redescribed as lesbian sex, and that particularly impacts lesbians. It's not really having that much of an effect on gay men yet, because trans men are not
gay men being accused of bigotry for retaining the prior conception of homosexuality the same way you are with lesbians.
Not so
and
much.
I think there's something very strong here. I mean, you know, we should remember that until very recently, the people who were charging gay and lesbian people with immorality were right-wing conservatives, right? Mm-hmm. And religious types and all this sort of thing. And now the people accusing them of bigotry are the people on the opposite side of it, right?
Yeah, and again, they just lost their critical faculties. They're under a spell, as far as I can see. You know, these changes of category, they're just not thinking through what it means. And it's all being propped up by a lot of cis people in the, you know, I don't like the word cis, but that's how it would be described. You know, we should also say this isn't really coming from trans people so much as trans activism. And that is not...
No. Yes, that's what we've been talking about.
In any way coextensive with trans people as a whole or anything like that.
Do you have any opinion or feeling? And this is, I promise, the last thing I want to ask you. My historical memory is relatively long. I mean, I was born in 1968, so I can remember when the only women in offices were secretaries. I can remember when, you know, when gay, when you had to hide the fact that you were gay or it was a career ender. I mean, I can remember all that very well. Here's something that what sort of strikes me, and I'm wondering whether you have a feeling about this. It feels to me like women and gays and lesbians only really came into their own in our society a proverbial 5 minutes ago. Why do you think so many on the ostensible left it's been so easy to get over it so fast, right? To where now they're acting almost like gay, like traditional gay lesbians and women and feminists are like a privileged class.
Do
you have any feelings about or thoughts about how this happened so quickly within the consciousness of the left, of what we normally would call the left?
I don't know if I've got any very coherent thoughts.
Got gay marriage.
I remember feeling that in philosophy, weirdly, like, I don't know, 15 years ago, where there was a time in which the pronouns in academic philosophy were changed from he to she. So if you were using an example, it became fashionable for people to say she as opposed to he, which is really quite a big surprise, because I'd grown up with reading like philosophy from the 50s and 60s where the default was the man, etc. And suddenly it was she, and it was like, great. And then I remember there was a discussion in my department because some students had said that was, you know, we need to get rid of that because they were non-binary and like we need to say they. And there was this people were taking this very seriously, and I thought, well, hang on, it's been like 4 years of the female pronoun as the default in a way that's obviously supposed to correct some very long-standing issue, and now that's gone now.
Do you think that this sort of activism has an inherently very anxious and impatient energy that it kind of has to you know what I mean? It's very strange.
Strange, and social media is giving it rocket fuel. There's no institutional memory of what happened only 20, 30 years ago. You know, people are now saying in Britain that they're just, I don't know, they're sort of retconning gay history to fit the current narrative, as far as I can see. Like, the new backstory is it was all about gender identity all along, or Section 28 was really about gender identity, or, you know, it's just, and no, you know, attention spans are so short and information's coming in so fast. So in other words, I suppose I'm connecting up to the general problems we're having with truth at the moment.
We're becoming more and more presentist because the information and the access is so enormous that you can't, it's getting harder to see past the current moment, not easier.
And we don't have the capacity, many of us, to tell the true from the false. Everything's being asserted so confidently. And then we're all subject to social norms, which is, you know, as a matter, we're hardwired for them. And we're in social media, so we're exposed to them a lot more, and particularly linguistic norms. So they just get their own energy.
All right, Kathleen, we made it to the end.
Yay.
And I did make it in under an hour and a half, as I promised. Although only 7 minutes under, so I do apologize.
It's okay. No, I enjoyed it. It's great.
The book is Material Girls. Could you hold it up again, please?
And it's available in the US from September the 21st.
Yes.
But you can get it on a Kindle now, or you can order it from Blackwell's.
I ordered it from Blackwell from the UK. I have read the book completely. And while I agree with it, I really do think that even people who don't agree with it are going to get a lot out of it, because it's not primarily combative. It is opinionated, but it's not rhetorical or polemical. And thank you so much for talking to me. And is it doing well so far? Do you have any sense of the figures?
Well, it was published here last Thursday. And on Tuesday, it was, they do these charts, and it was number 11 in hardback nonfiction for the UK.
That's wonderful.
So that's pretty amazing.
I'm sure you are thrilled, and your publisher is thrilled too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kathleen Stock, Material Girls, and I'll see you around the internet universe.
Okay, Dan, thanks so much.